This is Sean.
And Chris.
From Childhood Remastered.
We wanted to take some time to thank all our listeners for tuning in each and every week.
We do this podcast if no one was listening, but having you all along for the journey makes it all the better.
So keep those requests and comments coming. And now, on with the show.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Childhood Remastered. This is the podcast where we look back on the TVs and movies and cartoons and whatnot of our youth and see if they're still worth a damn.
Or not.
Or not, which is far too often the case. I am Sean.
And I'm Chris.
And today we are going to be jumping back in the Wayback Machine, heading back to the year 2000 for a show that Chris had never seen before.
I had never seen this one.
And that show is Titan A.E.
Once in a great while, mankind unlocks a secret so profound that our future is altered forever. Fire, electricity, splitting the atom. At the dawn of the 31st century, we unlocked another. It had the potential to change humanity's role in the universe. We called it the Titan Project, and it was a testament to the limitless power of the human imagination. Perhaps that is what the Dredge feared most, for it brought them down upon us without warning and without mercy. Kale, that day, the day the Dredge descended from the sky, the only thing that mattered was keeping you safe.
You said show, but it's a movie. I'm going to correct you.
Oh, yeah, sorry. It was a movie. It was a theatrical release movie.
It's, so what are your memories of Titan A.E.?
I remember, I'm pretty positive I saw this in the theater, or if not in the theater, pretty soon after on home video. I liked this movie because it was in the same vein as, like, Anastasia and, like, it's a Don Bluth movie. And it has that Don Bluth look and feel to it. Like I said, it's the character designs, because they're mostly human, at least the main characters are mostly human, are very much in the same vein as like Anastasia.
Right.
And it was action-packed. It was high, like, had a lot of high-end people in it. The casting was great.
Yeah.
A lot of good actors and a lot of fairly big-name actors as well. And there was just... I felt like it had a really good story, and it was well-paced, and overall it was just a really good movie. And since it came out, I get the feeling that it's not gotten as much notoriety.
Love, notoriety,
as it should have, because I honestly think it's a really good movie. Even I did before, and looking back on it now, after having rewatched it again, I still think it's a damn good movie.
I remember nothing of this. Like, I remember it came out. So, it came out, it was theatrically released June 16th of 2000 by 20th Century Fox and Fox Animation Studios. The movie only grossed $36.8 million, and it ended up with a $100 million loss for the studio. And we had discussed that in our earlier episode on Rockadoodle.
Yeah.
So was this
the movie that killed Don Bluth Studio?
This is the movie that killed Fox Animation / Don Bluth.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think he's really done anything since. My memory of this is simply that it was about space, that there was some CG, and that Matt Damon was in it. And that's all I remember. I remember nothing else. Yeah. So for me, this was like a big... it was kind of exciting because it was a movie that I was always like, yeah, I always wondered if that was any good. I want to see that. And I just never got around to it.
You never got to?
No.
Well, before we get any further, what are we drinking today?
Well, you are drinking water because Sean is a bitch.
I am drinking water, and let me explain. Friday, we're recording this on a Sunday. Friday night, I was out in Santa Monica. That's Los Angeles area, for those of you not familiar, for a friend's birthday, at which I drank copious amounts, And so it didn't feel too good the next day, Saturday, yesterday.
And then we went
to the Orange County Fair, which just opened this weekend, and I had probably 4 or 5 32-ounce beers.
Yeah, we had the same amount, I think. Yeah.
And then earlier today, for my future father-in-law's birthday, we went to a brewery, and
you were drinking this morning.
So I had about 3 more beers, so at this point, I'm just feeling gross.
You got me day drinking.
Yeah.
Sunday drinking, yeah. Yeah, I'm having scotch. So, scotch. I love down. Scotch. Yeah. Down in my belly. So, doing scotch.
I'll take the bitch status for today.
Okay.
Mostly because I've drunk. Someone get Grammar Girl on the line. I have drunk in probably excess of 2 gallons of beer over the last 3 days. So, I think I'm good.
Yeah, Joy and I went to see a movie and go to dinner. And yeah, we were drinking at dinner. And that was the first time her and I had ever gone out on our own that wasn't to a wedding since before our kid was born.
Oh.
Yeah.
Date night.
Yeah. Mommy, daddy night out.
Yeah.
And then we went home and we went to bed at like 11:30. And we slept until like 8.
Nice. So, back to the movie. Did you do the same thing I did when I saw the credits roll and I saw that this was produced by Don Bluth and Gary Goldman? I thought, Gary Oldman produced this movie? Because I totally did not see the G, and it wasn't until later when it was, I think they directed it too,
well,
together.
Well, I built up, because, you know, if you listen to the show, you know, like, I build a lot of the notes, and then Sean builds his own notes kind of separate, and then I have my own other set of notes. So, like, our shared notes that I built out for all of the production and trivia and stuff, I had already done it when I watched the movie, and so I saw that, and I was like, Gary Oldman? And then I was like, no, it's not Gary Oldman, it's Gary Goldman. So like, I had the same moment, but...
I did a double take at the screen. I was like, what? Yeah. Oh, no, yeah, Gary Goldman.
So, as I had said earlier, we had talked about Don Bluth before. He's the one who directed this, along with Gary Goldman. They co-directed it. And Don Bluth, we discussed on Rockadoodle. He started at Disney by working as an assistant on Sleeping Beauty. And he quit for 2 years to do his mission trip with LDS. Went back to Disney and worked from Robin Hood, Rescuers of Pete's Dragon, and then left in 79 to produce during the production of Fox and the Hound. That's during the mass exodus where he took 17% of their staff.
Back after, as a result of them making the Black Cauldron.
Yeah, well, part of it. It was he said that some of the choices that Disney was making was lazy, and that he didn't like the direction that they were going.
Yeah.
And some of that you can see in the special effects used on Black Cauldron, but some of it was also starting to get used on Fox and the Hound. So he left during that, delayed Fox and the Hound's release, and then did, I believe, Secret of Nim with Gary Goldman.
Yeah, I was going to say that Don Bluth, and I think I've said this before, Don Bluth is probably responsible for, not probably, he's responsible for a lot of the movies that you and I and anyone in our generation remember really fondly, like Secret of Nim.
If you were born in the 80s,
or the late 70s. Early 80s.
So I would say the early millennials. So I'd say late 70s.
That weird generational thing where we're the Xennials from 1978 to 1983.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
No, it's 78 to, I think, 86.
Whatever it is. So it's Secret of Nim, and American Tale, Land Before Time.
Yeah.
All Dogs Go to Heaven.
And then even some of the true millennials and their remembrance of Anastasia.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, they're both responsible for that. And, you know, we don't really need to go into too much because we covered them a lot before. The screenplay on this is Ben Edlund, John August, and Joss Whedon.
Yeah, a little unknown screenwriter named Joss Whedon.
And a little unknown Ben Edlund, who you might know as being the creator of The Tick.
Which is a great comic book if you've never read it. Not like the cartoon that much.
No, but the cartoon show is fun, and there's a new live action coming out. They did it's actually already out. It's on, I think, Amazon. Mm. Amazon Video did it. John August did the Charlie's Angels movies, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory remake, and Corpse Bride. And if you don't know who Joss Whedon is, I don't know what rock you've been living under. Because he created Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Angel and Firefly. Oh, Firefly.
Oh. Also wrote Serenity.
Co-wrote Toy Story, Cabin in the Woods, which is my favorite horror film, because I don't even like horror normally. I find them boring, but Cabin in the Woods is...
Well, it's a horror movie. It's a horror genre.
Give it away. Say nothing. It's just so good.
Yeah.
Wrote and directed this movie called The Avengers. It's fine. It's probably not popular or anything.
Yeah.
And apparently he wasn't very happy with the way Titan A.E. came out. I was reading an interview. If I can find the interview again, I'll put it in the link in the description, but we'll see.
Yeah, so. Produced by Fox Animation Studios and our old friend David Kirschner.
Yeah, Black Cauldron.
Black Cauldron. And wasn't
Black Cauldron, sorry.
Wasn't he involved with Pagemaster as well?
I think so.
That whole...
Yeah, it was him
the
on
whole controversy.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So he did this one too. I wonder who he screwed out of writing credits for this one.
Who knows? Well, maybe nobody, because look at who's named under screenplay. Not him.
Not him, yeah.
Yeah.
Three people, but no David Kushner.
Yeah. Kirschner. So music is done by Graham Revel, and the background music for Titan A.E. was composed by him, but there's a bunch of other songs that are not his. So the official album containing the film's underscore was originally not released with the movie, and it didn't get a release until October 23rd of 2014.
Hmm.
And by La La Land Records.
The music in this movie is, I think it does a good job of setting the mood in a lot of points. The score.
Now, the actual soundtrack quote, I'll get into when we discuss the movie more, because I have a story about what happened while we were watching it. But
it's like a who's who, all the people on the soundtrack. It's like a who's who of early 2000s alternative rock.
Oh man, yeah, so hard. Lit, Power Man 5000, Electricity, Fun Loving Criminals, The Urge, Texas Bliss 66, Jamiroquai,
Splashdown, Wailing Souls, and Luscious Jackson.
Yeah. I have something I want to mention in a few minutes when we get there. So, who was in this box office flop?
Well, a lot of really big name people, actually. So, the main character's name is Kale Tucker, just named after the vegetable, the vegetable.
Yeah, I got, okay, yeah.
So, Kale is, we see him twice. We see him in the beginning of the movie as a flashback, where he's a child and he's on Earth, and the antagonist of the movie called the Scourge?
The Dredge.
The Dredge. Why did I think the Scourge? I don't know. So the antagonists of the movie are the Dredge, who are these like energy beings who are trying to wipe out humanity.
Yeah.
And they, the beginning of the movie, they are attacking Earth, or they're on the way to attack Earth, so everyone on Earth is loading up, or at least everyone, every fortunate person on Earth, is loading up into these escape vessels to flee the Dredge.
I have words on those two, but go ahead.
To flee the Dredge. And we see young Kale with his father, played by Ron Perlman.
Yeah.
Who is constructing this, or has been taking part in constructing this ship called the Titan. And he gives young Kale, who's played by Alex Linz, who was in, he was the kid in Home Alone 3, and the voice of young Tarzan in the movie Tarzan.
Yeah.
And he gives him to his buddy, companion, weird sort of anteater alien guy.
Played by our old buddy, Tone Loke.
Yeah. And he gives, what was that character?
We covered him on Ferngully, which is our episode 28. His name is Tech.
Tech.
Yeah, he's the alien friend who raised Kale while Sam was away.
Yeah, so when the ship leaves, then you get a shot of the Earth getting essentially destroyed and a bunch of ships getting blown up. And then fast forward, I think it was 10 years later or 15 years later. I think it was 15. And you have Kale as a grown-ass man who is now a salvage worker. And
who is voiced by?
Matt Damon!
Matt
Damon, who you may know as having an Oscar for co-writing and starring in Good Will Hunting, Saving Private Ryan, my favorite, which is Dogma. Love Dogma
so
much.
The Departed. He plays Jason Bourne. He was in the Martian, where he was science the shit out of stuff.
Science the shit out of a potato. Which sounds like something got too sexual.
Yeah.
So his dad, you mentioned Ron Perlman. His dad is Professor Sam Tucker, who's this researcher who helped develop this thing called Project Titan that we'll get into later.
Yeah.
So whenever, if I hear his voice, the first thing that comes to mind is...
War. War never changes.
From Fallout.
I'm a huge Fallout franchise fan.
I am too. So he is the narrator for nearly every Fallout game except for the new Fallout 4. He does play a character in Fallout 4, but he's not the narrator, I don't think.
I think he still does. No, he doesn't do the War Never Changes in that one, does
yeah,
he?
Yeah, he doesn't. Oh. He's probably best known, though, for his early 2000s depiction of Hellboy. And more recently, he's best known for his role in Sons of Anarchy as Clay Morrow. But he's had like dozens and dozens of roles over the year. But he got his start on something that we discussed, I think, on an earlier show.
Oh my God! Yeah,
the live action Beauty and the Beast that aired from 1987 to 1990, and his co-star was the mom from Terminator, Sarah Connor. I can't remember the actress's name, but I know Ron Perlman was the voice of the narrator in the game Bastion in 2011, but I can't find the information anywhere, which is weird. I know for a fact, and I even booted up the game to hear his voice.
Maybe it was someone doing a Ron Perlman impersonation.
No, it's him. and it plays like in the credits or whatever, but when you look it up, if you look it up on voice acting websites or IMDb or Wikipedia, and you check Ron Perlman or the game or the anything, it's not linked, but I know for a fact it's him. Mm. And if you haven't played that game, it's awesome. It came out in 2011. I don't care that that's a sidetrack. You can look at me sour all you want. That's a great game.
So then we got Captain Joseph Corso, who is a secondary protagonist, I guess. He's the captain of the Valkyrie and an old colleague of Kale's father. He is played by Bill Pullman.
Lone Star from Spaceballs.
I was going to say, not Bill Paxton. Not Paxton, you fool! It's Bill Pullman. He was also the president, played the president in Independence Day, gave that super rousing speech that everyone tries to imitate, but no one can.
Yeah, it had, so I just put this in here because I was like, you know how you do, you get in the Wikipedia rabbit hole or IMDb or wherever. Independence Day had a budget of $75 million and a box office of $817 million. That's awesome. I didn't put this in here, but I calculated that $817 million and $75 million for today. The $817 million for today is almost $1.3 billion.
Damn.
That movie would have made today. And the $75 million budget then would have been a $120 million budget.
So it's basically like Avengers.
But even more profitable, because Avengers probably cost them several hundred million dollars.
Probably.
Yeah. So I just had to go off that. But I can't see Bill Pullman without thinking of him as the president from Independence Day.
Yeah. Then we have Goon, who is an amphibian-like green alien. He's a
Gripoan-like. We're supposed to know what that is.
Yeah, and he's sort of a catch-all scientist. He's a science officer aboard the Valkyrie. And he's played by John Leguizamo of Super Mario Brothers fame, and also, what was the TV show that he did?
Go ahead and poke that bear, Sean. Go ahead.
Poke that bear? He played...
He played
Luigi Mario.
You guys can't see it, but he gave me a funny look when he mentioned Mario Brothers, because I really want to do Mario Brothers, and I have yet to start working on the notes. It's going to be a long time coming, but...
What was the name of his show? Culture Clash. That was his sketch comedy show.
Yeah.
And then he was also in...
Benny in Carlito's Way.
He was Chi-Chi Rodriguez.
I love...
Tu Wong Fu. Thanks for everything.
I love Tu Wong Fu. I love that movie. And I will always remember him as the Violator in Spawn.
The Violator. Yeah.
And if you got kids, though, they would know his voice as Sid the Sloth from the Ice Age movies. So Nathan Lane is in this as Predex or Preed, who's a fruit bat-looking alien called a Arcrenian. And Nathan Lane is probably best known as Timon from The Lion King, but I know him as Albert from The Birdcage.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And I also loved him in The Producers.
Yes.
His version of The Producers is great. Deutschland is happy and gay. So, did I ever... This is a little side thing about Nathan Lane, but did I ever tell you that I pulled my shirt off and showed Nathan Lane my boobs once? My man boobs?
No.
I did.
No. Did he sign him?
No. He looked at me incredulously. So I went to a taping for a TV show, because we live here in Southern California. You can do this for free. You can just go and sit in on a taping for a TV show for syndication.
Kathy and I are going to do that.
Yeah, it's fun. And it's free entertainment. And I was in high school, and I had a friend of mine kind of write us out of class. He was on ASB, so he could excuse us. So he wrote us out, and it was several of us, and we piled into his Acura Integra.
Oh, my God.
And it was like forest green, and we drove up to L.A., and we sat in on the – we tried to get tickets to Will and Grace or Friends, but we couldn't get in, and so we ended up doing this doing a show that never ended up on syndication. Or it did, but it got like one season. It was like a political comedy that was sort of trying, I think, to copy the Michael J. Fox Spin City show. And so it was a break in the filming, and I'm sitting in like the second row of the audience, and I called out, "Hey, Nathan Lane!" And I pulled up my shirt, and I just went, "Woo! Girls gone wild!
Oh my God!
Give me my beads!" And the guy was giving out beads, like beaded necklaces to people who like cheered a lot. And so he just threw like a handful of them at me.
I think I would have looked at you incredulously too.
Yeah, that's like my one encounter with Nathan Lane. Because, you know, I don't care. Celebrities are just people, so.
Fuck them.
Yeah.
So then we got Stith, who is a weird looking, interesting character. She's like essentially a kangaroo with giant bowing legs.
And sort of leathery skin.
Yeah, and her character is super aggressively like violent.
Yeah. She's cool though.
Yeah, she's the weapons officer essentially on the ship.
She's Janine Garofalo. And holy shit, she's 52. And that makes her feel really old.
Yeah.
Because one, she looks good at 52.
She does.
Two,
I think you can catch her on CISO if you have that service, that provider. I think you can get it through Amazon. I have it to see that my brother and
she's
me
a
show.
Co-host of Air America.
She was because Air America is no more.
Yeah, but she was a co-host of Air America.
Yeah.
And you know, people know her from Reality Bites and The Truth About Cats and Dogs. But I'd say my favorite role of hers is from Wet Hot American Summer.
What about that?
I love that movie.
What about that movie?
I know what movie it is. The one with Ben Stiller and the superheroes? Yeah. God damn it, I can read your mind now.
Yeah.
This has gotten weird.
What was that movie called?
I don't remember. But
she was the only one arguably with any superpower in that movie because she had that bowling ball. She was the bowler. And the bowling ball actually like moved around because it had the ghost of her father or something
that she
in
could
it.
Control. Yeah. Now, this next person, I personally felt like she kind of phoned it in. The character is Akima, who is the pilot of the ship and Kale's love interest, and it's voiced by Drew Barrymore.
Mystery Men, by the way.
Mystery Men, thank you. Thank you. Yeah.
She totally...
I felt like she kind of phoned it in on this. But she is a very famous actress. She got her start as a child actor on E.T., although she had done work before that. That kind of is what blew her up.
Yeah, that's what got her all of her substance abuse problems.
Yeah, she's very public about that. She had some issues, and she cleaned up later. She ended up getting signed on to Scream. I guess she was originally supposed to play the lead character, but at the last minute couldn't do it, and so still wanted to be in the movie.
They gave it to Neve Campbell instead.
And she ended up getting the first on-screen death, very famously, and that I think actually worked out well for her. So
yeah.
And then she did The Wedding Singer, which was one of my favorite movies of all time.
And she went on to do like how many movies with Adam Sandler to the point of it being a joke?
A lot, like 50 First Dates and however many other ones. And Charlie's Angels. And you were talking to me about the Netflix series she's on, Santa Clarita Diet, I haven't seen yet.
Yeah, it's essentially a zombie show.
It looks cool, though. I haven't seen it.
Yeah.
I don't think she's a bad actress. I just think in this particular case, she had other stuff going on.
Yeah.
Because this came out around the same time that Charlie's Angels, the first one, I think, came out. It was around 2000. So, you know, she was busy doing other things. So, the next character is a very quick character appearance. He's this anthropomorphic cockroach who doesn't even get a name. And the character brutally gets murdered, killed, and it's voiced by Jim Brewer, of SNL fame. He's a comedian, and he is very funny. He was in Half Baked, and I know him as Goat Boy from SNL,
yeah.
But I have never heard of Opie and Anthony, and I know that that's bad because he's on it all the time. But yeah,
it's a show that was on the East Coast, sort of in the same vein as like Howard Stern, like very much a shock jock type show. And I think they ended up getting kicked off the air, and they went to like Sirius Satellite.
Yeah, I guess one of them got removed from the show like just a week or two ago.
Not that long ago.
Yeah, I think he'd done like taking a picture of somebody in the bathroom or something.
Hooray!
Yay!
Then you have the Dredge Queen. Who, honestly, at any point in the movie, did they refer to her as a queen?
No,
did they refer to her as a her?
If I didn't know it was a supposed to be a queen, I wouldn't have known. If I hadn't have read this and done these notes before, I would have had no idea.
Yeah, because in the movie, they never refer to her, or they never refer to the character as any kind of gender or any kind of anything. You just assume that it's the leader of the Dredge because this character comes out and is visually different than the rest of the Dredge and is giving orders to the Dredge.
Yeah.
But they never like, oh, our queen, hail our queen or anything.
And they always sort of sound video game-ish and metallic.
Yeah.
They speak some weird language that's uninterpretable.
Yeah. The character was quote unquote voiced by Christopher Scarabosio. Yeah,
weirdly enough, he's not even a voice actor. He's a sound editor.
Well, there wasn't really even a voice. I can understand.
I think they recorded his voice and like ran it through a bunch of filters is what they did.
Or he just created some kind of audio sound because the voice, and I'll play it here. The voice of the Dredge is just sort of just noise.
Yeah.
It's like if you were listening to feedback on a radio or something. It's just, meh.
Yeah. Well, he has done a lot of work. He worked on Titanic, the first three Star Wars, or Star Wars Episode 1, 2, and 3. Not the first three, the three prequels.
Yeah.
Hellboy, Pearl Harbor, and the Despicable Me movies. So it's not like he doesn't get work. You know, I just think that in this case, in this movie, it was something that didn't end up panning out. So
yeah, then we have three guys that are sort of, they're not sort of, they are minor characters in the movie, but
I only put this next one in because we've covered him so much, and just to not put him in would just be ridiculous.
Yeah, the character of Chalquin, who is a like a bully essentially that picks on Kale for being human,
that we see all of 5 seconds of, and it's Jim Cummings.
Yeah, and then there's a couple other ones named Firakesh, who is another guy that picks on Kale for being human. He's done by Charles Rocket.
And I also put him in there mostly just because I remembered his voice, and then I remembered him from as being the main villain in Dumb and Dumber,
mm-hmm.
and then also as being the dad in Hocus Pocus. So
yeah, and then the last...
I guess he was actually part of the SNL cast from 80 to 81.
That was like the lost years of SNL.
Yes, yes it was.
So then we have Poe, who is another alien guy who's an asshole to Kale because he's a human, and he is played by Ken Hudson Campbell.
Who was in Home Alone as the Santa,
the random Santa that's just wandering around the McAllister house.
Yeah. What? And then Down Periscope and Armageddon.
Yeah.
Oh, he's the nice guy in the hall in Groundhog Day.
Yeah.
Yay. So let's, there's some other stuff we can talk about. Like, let's maybe talk about the movie and maybe we can jump back if you want.
Yeah, so the plot of the movie is essentially humanity is nearly wiped out by the Dredge, who, like I said, they are this almost pure energy race. The design of their character is all CGI. All the Dredge stuff is CGI. And this movie mixes traditional animation with CGI, I think, fairly well. For the time, I mean, it's 2000.
It's held up decently well.
It doesn't look super just, you know, when you watch some of those older movies, like when we watched the Power Rangers movie that came out in, what was that, 96?
Okay, yeah, that was not
like
good.
Like garbage CGI. Yeah. And this movie came out four years later, but probably since it was an animated movie, it probably went into production in like 98 or 99.
Its budget was also much larger. Like, much larger. No, so,
this movie was?
This movie.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So, it's a hybrid movie.
I think in total the budget, if I'm trying to remember, because I don't have the notes for our old Power Rangers episode open in front of me, but if I'm trying to remember, I think that Power Rangers movie went over budget at like $77 million or $75 million, and this made $39 million, and lost $100 million.
Jeez.
So that means the production and the cost was double, which is probably why it looks so much better.
Yeah.
You know?
So the whole plot of this movie is that humanity is kicked off of Earth by the Dredge. The Dredge is trying to wipe out humanity.
They destroyed Earth in the first 5 minutes of the movie.
Yeah, they destroyed Earth and they tried to destroy the people escaping Earth. And so now humanity is scattered.
In the stars.
Yeah, it's scattered.
It's like Battlestar Galactica.
I was going to say, remember the line in The Fifth Element, since it's coming up on the 20th anniversary, or it is now, probably by the time this episode is released, that what does Zorg say to the Mandalorians, or the Mandalore, or whatever, where he says,
it's like, Mandalorians, this isn't Kodor.
Yeah, you know the
yeah, yeah,
the dog aliens. He says, you guys are warriors, proud warriors. It's not your fault that your people were scattered to the wind by the government.
That's awesome. I don't remember that at all.
Yeah, it's when he's showing him the gun.
Yeah.
But that's essentially what's happened to humanity, is they're scattered to the wind of the universe.
Well, so, and I have a bone to pick on this, because they have a ship that gets away, which is the Titan Project, that supposedly is why the Dredge are after humanity.
I will say that it's not necessarily, it's never really explicitly explained why the Dredge hate humanity. There's people that give explanations, but you never really get a concrete answer of why they want to wipe out humanity.
Oh, no, I have an explanation. We'll get to it. Okay. I know why.
Okay.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's not anywhere that I found online. I'm just watching it. I was like, oh, that's why.
Yeah.
So, but something that I thought about is this movie is supposed to take place in the year 3028. Now, why, in roughly, give or take, 1,000 years from now, are they still using fucking helicopters?
Space helicopters.
No.
I know that.
On Earth, they're using helicopters. Now, they spent all this time to create the Titan. Now, spoiler to the end of this episode here. The Titan Project is this large ship that essentially can create
a planet.
It can literally create a planet. And it has the genetic makeup on the ship to recreate every species on Earth.
Yeah. It's essentially the Genesis Project from Star Trek 2.
Yeah, basically. So they put their time and money and effort into that without thinking about the fact that the universe is a hostile place. Maybe we should have weapons to protect this Titan Project. And so they end up having militaristic capabilities of, I would say, the mid-21st century. They're flying around in helicopters.
They've devoted all of their resources to scientific exploration and colonization.
There's no, like, orbital array protecting the planet. They talk about...
So, basically, this movie is what happens when we stop funneling money into the industrial-military complex and actually start sending it into science and STEM.
No.
Is that what you're saying?
No. Star Trek with proton torpedoes.
Take your tinfoil hat off, Alex Jones.
Oh, God. Oh, secret underground lizard people, Sean.
They're underground lizard people.
They're everywhere. No, yeah. So, oh, God.
I totally sidetracked you on that one.
No. It's actually kind of on the right path.
Yeah. So they devote all their time, money, and energy into this scientific
project
endeavor.
Without thinking about protecting it. And the reason why I wanted to go here
and
next...
it's not like they don't know that there's other species around. They
because
know
there are other planets or other species living on Earth.
Yeah, and they are aware of the Dredge.
Yes. And so the other thing that I wanted to get to as a part of this mention is that when they leave, when the Dredge destroy Earth, they are, first of all, they're destroying Earth with, like, little fighter ships first. They're attacking the human ships that are leaving.
Mm-hmm.
And the human ships that they're leaving look just like Klingon Birds of Prey. I don't know if you noticed that, but they look just like them.
Are you talking about the Dredge ships?
Yeah, that's what I said.
Yeah, okay, yeah, the Dredge fighters.
As they're destroying the human ships with the Dredge fighters, they look just like Birds of Prey, to the point where my wife...
Who's
a big Star Trek nerd. I would say maybe even more than me. She then turns to my daughter and corrects her to tell her that those are Klingon Birds of Prey. She goes, sweetie, no, those aren't the alien ships. Those are Klingon Birds of Prey. And which I thought was kind of cool. But the ships that they're destroying, the human ships, I wanted to talk about, because those look like, the inside of the ships look like a modern day Econo airline. And all I could think of was, hey everyone, let's escape Earth on Southwest. Like really?
Maybe I want to be killed.
Well, if that's a, if that's a way you have to travel through space is economy, I guess. But like, why would they not have put money into this? It was just like a weird design choice. I thought like everything is because, super futuristic. Because and
they funneled all their money into scientific research and nothing into aesthetics.
But you would think that that scientific research would have ended up in like ending hunger and all these things. And
or maybe it did. Well, we only get 5 minutes of planet Earth.
That's true. We do. But it looks rather desolate.
Yeah. Well, so, yeah. Where they're doing it, where the only action that we see from Earth is sort of in a open field because it's, you know, imagine if you've seen the new Star Trek movies. In the first one, where Kirk like rides out to like the shipyard in Iowa, where he sees
it's like the middle of nowhere. Yeah,
it's in the middle of nowhere, just a giant field. That's essentially what they're doing. They have this sort of military science base in the middle of a field. Yeah. Middle of nowhere.
It's, you know, it's. At, I will say that when the Earth explodes, we get these cool special effects, and I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
And Joy like was rocking out
because Joy had seen this movie and she really liked it. Right.
Joy had not only seen this movie and loved it. Joy had seen this movie, loved it, and owned the soundtrack on CD.
This movie was her jam.
So
you made her night.
Oh yeah, we definitely made her night. Mm-hmm. No, not to get weird, but she did. Late. She loved this movie. Joy.
To get weird, but she did.
Yes. No, when Joy gets home from work after listening to this, because sometimes she listens to the show. She doesn't always, but sometimes she does. So I'm sure she'll listen to this one, and she's going to come home and make fun of me. I'm sure of it. So she loved the soundtrack to this movie, and she, at one point, during a montage when they're playing music,
mm-hmm.
she knew the words to the songs, one of which was Marilyn Manson.
Yeah.
And I was like, why do you know the words to a Marilyn Manson song? But we're sitting up, we have two couches that face each other with the TV kind of on another wall. And I was watching her and Eleanor to kind of see the reaction. And I look over and Joy's mouthing all the words to the song.
This movie was super her jam.
Like way her jam. So, you know, fast forward into the future and we get older Kale, and I can't not think of the vegetable. And
yeah.
He ends up taking off with Corso and they escape. That's when Jim Brewer's character gets killed.
Yeah, and the reason that he escapes is because Corso and his team find him, and when they escape the planet, Kale's father gives him this ring, and he tells him, as long as you have this ring, there's still hope, yada yada. And,
which just at first seems like sentimental BS.
Yeah, and Corso finds Kale and basically tells him, like, the ring is a map, and he does something to the ring to make it light up so that when he puts it on, it creates this sort of compass map on his hand.
Yeah.
It's bio-encoded only for his father or him, so they're the only ones that can use it. And the map is to the Titan project, or the Titan ship, and that's why it's humanity's last hope at essentially having a planet since Earth was blown up.
And they escape this, like, space station, and we don't need to get into everything, but I did want to say that there's a point where when they escape the space station, they end up in like an escape pod and they break the glass on it because it's cracked and they need to get out. And they use a fire extinguisher to kind of shoot and propel themselves towards their other ship in open space with no suits on. And he just tells him to blow the air out and to hold his breath.
I think you have to close your eyes too.
Well, the thing is it's, what would happen in about 5 seconds in the vacuum of space is you would just freeze to death.
Yeah.
You would just freeze. That would be it. You'd freeze. But they're cognizant all the way through, which I thought was weird.
They were wearing coats.
Yeah, I guess. So when they end up back in the ship, Kale is asleep and he wakes up and Akima tells Kale to hold still or he will lose something really important.
They don't bathe much either.
I'm still naked here.
I hadn't noticed. Now hold still or you lose something really important. Hand me the probe.
And then Kale asks, where's the probe go? And we also encounter a large kangaroo-type lizard girl and a weird semi-turtle Nengoon. And that's our, like, weird introduction to the characters. But we don't get any intro like, hi, my name is. It's just like they come on scene and then they're gone without a whole lot of, like, anything in between. Which is weird, I think.
Yeah. Well, they're secondary characters that don't, they don't do a ton. So the main storyline is that Corso is using Kale to find the Titan Project because Corso worked with Kale's father on the project. He seems like a military guy. And the whole point is to find it because they want to essentially get all of humanity to come back to this planet, the humanity that's left. And they essentially do that. Throughout the movie, they are avoiding the Dredge, who are trying to get a hold of Kale and not kill him because they want to find the Titan ship and destroy it. And you have, I want to say hijinks, but it's, you know, sci-fi action adventure that ensues. And you
several times.
Yeah, yeah. The Dredge come and shoot up the ship or shoot up wherever they are. They eventually go, they wind up at this planet that has these aliens. I forget what they're called, but they're essentially, if you've seen the movie, I think Beastmaster, they're like these humanoid bat people.
Okay, so there's something I wanted to mention at this point, but go ahead.
So these are like supposedly the oldest or one of the oldest and one of the wisest species in the universe, and they apparently worked with Kale's dad on this project, even though they're freaking light years from Earth. And they, through the interaction Kale has with them, they explain to him how the map works, how to use the map to direct him. And they go through this whole pantomime thing, but then the Dredge attack and the Dredge start shooting up the bird people, the bat people, and the bat people sacrifice themselves to get Kale and the rest of them back to their little water skiff, and they get back to the ship.
What I had two questions. So the first one is, why are they sacrificing themselves? They seem pretty ready to sacrifice themselves for people they don't know for a project that's not going to benefit them.
Yeah, I don't know. I had to assume that they just either owed something to Kale's father, or they're just that enlightened that they are willing to sacrifice themselves for a species that's like basically extinct.
For me, that was like a big plot hole. The other thing, because I'm married to a chemist, Joy is meanwhile trying to figure out where the hydrogen comes from in these hydrogen trees. So on this planet, there are these, the whole planet is mostly covered with water. Water, by the way, not something else.
Not like some kind of methane, liquid methane.
It is water. And the water has these sort of, they look like,
they're like vines.
It looks like grapes.
Yeah.
Like grape bunches that grow up out. But they're giant. Each grape would, say, be big enough for 6'4" Sean to get inside.
Wait, yeah, much bigger than that. They're big enough that...
Easily.
They're big enough that, like, the Dredge ships that are the size of big ships, like the fighter jets...
A Dredge is, like, the size
It's like
of,
a fighter jet.
Yeah.
So it's big enough that the Dredge ships that are the size of fighter jets can fly into them, and it's still bigger than them. They fly into them and explode.
Yes. Now, they're full of hydrogen, and Joy's wanting to know, well, they grow out of the water. Where does the hydrogen come from?
Some chemical process that splits the hydrogen and oxygen atoms, I guess, maybe?
I guess, but
why do they explode? So that's the thing, is that the and I wish I could remember the name of the aliens, but they clip
the Ga'ul.
The Ga'ul, okay. So they clip the hydrogen balloons, and they float up, and they use that as cover, because the Dredge keep running into them. And it's when they run into them, they explode. And it makes sense when Kale and...
But they shouldn't explode on contact.
No, though. But that's what I'm saying. It makes sense when Kale and What's-Her-Face shoot one of them and they explode with the gunshot or the laser shot, because there's actually an igniting source.
Yeah.
But the ship's just flying into them. It should just pop.
Yeah, should, but they don't. Now, at this point, Kale gets kidnapped and so does Akima. The Dredge ditch Akima. She gets picked up by some slavers.
Yeah, they literally put her in a pod and fire her out into space.
Yeah, and like a space funeral. And Kale gets captured by them, but realizes that he can just go up to the wall, stick two fingers at the same time to create a... a current short circuit, and or then he can walk through the wall.
He's able to he's able to like use the dredge technology, even though it's all energy based, and like he's able to he somehow hijacks a ship.
Yeah,
and he's able to fly the ship. And what how he flies it is he literally puts his hands above the armrests on the chair, and then light. Like attaches like those plasma balls to his fingers, and he's able to control the ship that way somehow without ever having used it before.
So once he gets back to everybody and everybody amalgamates together, because there's stuff that happens in the meantime, but once they get together, they then end up at this planet with a large ice ring. And the only reason why I wanted to mention that is because at that point, Eleanor goes, "It's so beautiful." And my wife turns to her and she goes, "Yeah, do you think it's beautiful?" And she goes, "It's so beautiful, Mommy. It fills up my soul."
Oh my God.
Yeah, like deep from a kid.
Seriously.
I will say it is very visually stunning. They do a good job.
I was telling Kathy when I was watching it.
Especially for 2000, I was not expecting the animation to look that good.
So essentially what it is it's a planet with a gigantic ice ring.
Oh, like, by the way, not to interrupt, but Joy also knew all the words to the song that played during the ice ring part.
So
I made note of that one because she was singing that.
So the ice ring around this planet is massive. Massive. To the point where the ice crystals that are in this ice ring are several times larger than the ship itself.
No, that's something later. That's not in this yet. So they end up at a planet with the ice rings, and that is when we get a betrayal.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
So that's a different
I'm something. Too far ahead.
But that's okay. We can skip around. But there is a point. So what happens is Corso betrays everybody.
Well, they overhear him. And they overhear him. That was his plan from the beginning.
And so they, Akima and Kale, Akima and Hipster Salad both leave. And they end up at this big base that has been amalgamated together through putting these space Southwest ships together. And people live there.
Yeah,
and they take one and they build a new one.
Yeah, what was it called? It was they escape, and it's like what is it? Thailand, Bangkok. It's like New Bangkok or something. Something. It's all.
Yeah,
Thai
it is. I put it in the notes. It's called New Bangkok.
New Bangkok. Yeah,
but they don't speak Thai.
What do they speak? Because
they're speaking Mandarin.
Okay. I was gonna say
which I thought was like, oh, all Asian people speak the same language.
Well. Maybe if it was a...
Because I was like, if that was Thai, that was the weirdest Thai I've ever heard. And I know what Thai sounds like.
Yeah, you've been there.
We have family there. Joy's half Thai. Like, I know what it sounds like.
Well, I was going to say, what if you had an Asian contingent?
Well, this is 1,000 years in the future. You could have had several languages that amalgamated into a new language.
Well, I was going to say...
That's possible, but it sounded like Mandarin.
Right now, there's, what, 1.3 billion Chinese? What if a group of them... Like, if a group of Asians left planet Earth and went somewhere else...
A bunch of different Asiatic countries speaking different languages, what language would eventually be spoken?
Probably Mandarin, because there's going to be more of them than anything else.
Yeah, probably.
So,
unless maybe. You include India, and then in which case it might actually end up being English.
Yeah, maybe.
So, but who knows?
So then they do this montage where they use...
We're gonna build a new ship in 20 minutes, but it's gonna last like 5 fucking days! That's basically what happens.
And they build a ship out of the original ship, I guess, that colony used to get where they are.
Yeah.
And by the way, did you notice that one of the ships that's in that giant amalgamation of New Bangkok is the Death Star?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty awesome, actually.
Yeah, so the Death Star is in there.
It's a Death Star without being the Death Star.
Yeah. So then that's where they get the big... clunky ship that shouldn't move the way it does, and that's when they end up in the
giant ice meteors.
Yeah, they wind up in a giant ice field where the ice, that's what I was talking about, where the ice crystals are several times larger than the ship. And if any of you have been to Disneyland and
the original Star Tours, it's gone.
And if you had ever been to the original Star Tours, not the one that they have now, the original
Star
one,
Tours, what are you doing?
Yeah, you wind up at some point in that ride on the ice moon, or you wind it up in like comets. Oh, that's what it was. The guy was like, comets, comets, comets. And you wind up going through like a comet storm.
Yeah.
And you essentially wind up in the same kind of predicament where you're flying through ice crystals.
Giant ice crystals. Yeah. So that's what happens.
That totally
here.
Reminded me. And this is the part where I thought, like, the visuals were amazing.
That was really impressive. Yeah.
Like, for a movie that's...
It was so impressive that it got to the point where I didn't even think about it.
Yeah, for a movie that's 17 years old, really, in production, it's probably 18 or 19 years old. The CGI...
Yeah, 98, 99, probably.
Yeah, the CGI was amazing. For just that, like, they essentially are able to escape...
That's why they ended up losing $100 million.
Yeah. They ended up escaping Corso and Preed because they used the reflection on the ice crystals to trick them into thinking they were going one way when they went another way, because there's just like crystals all over the place and there's reflections everywhere and they don't know which one's the real one. And then they find their way to the Titan ship
encased in ice, and they go inside, and Preed and Corso catch up to them.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, they've decided that their other crewmates, the weird turtle guy and kangaroo girl, because I don't remember their names. So,
Goon and Stith.
Thank you. I'm still going to call them Turtle Guy and Kangaroo Girl. Yeah. So Turtle Guy and Kangaroo Girl have apparently outused their usefulness.
Yeah, they've outlived their usefulness.
And Preed, Nathan Lane, has decided he's going to kill him. So he blows them up. And we get the scene where I was... 100% sure that they had just killed Turtle Guy.
Yeah.
And they didn't kill Turtle Guy. He ended up being alive.
Yeah, he says, oh, I'm fine. I just need to take a nap.
And then he closes his eyes and he's not breathing.
Yeah, he closes his eyes and he does one of those like...
Ergo, he's dead. He's fucking dead.
But no, he comes back.
No. And then we end up inside the Titan and you get Corso and Preed, and Preed ends up double-crossing everybody. And Corso and Preed fight, and that's when Corso full-on snaps his neck.
A la Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Like, full-on...
grabs him from behind, puts him in a headlock, and then snaps his neck and throws him down a flight of stairs.
Like a fucking action movie.
Yeah. And this is where I was telling you about this the other day. Or maybe it was earlier today. This day is long. It's all run together.
Could have been today.
But, no, it was today. So... This fight scene between Kale, because then Kale and Corso end up having a fight scene. And this fight scene between Kale and Corso really highlights to me, I think, the animation deficiency of Don Bluth Studios. In that...
If you can say that they have any deficiency, this is where it is, and I would agree.
So when the studio animates, whoever it is, animates... action scenes between two people.
Not animal-like people or animals, but people.
When humanoid characters, when they are fighting, when they are physically fighting, the animation seems stilted and slow and weird. Just weird. Like, think of the...
Almost like it feels like they are not connected to the world that they're in.
Yeah, and it's just... It's slow. It's like they're fighting in water. That's what it is. It's like they're fighting in a pool.
Yeah,
and their hands are moving slowly, and their legs are moving slowly. And
not slow, but slower than they should.
Yeah, and this
at like 3/4 speed.
Yeah, if you look at this scene with Corso and Kale, he throws punches, he does kicks, and it doesn't seem right. You think back to the and I can never remember the guy's name in Anastasia, that her the love interest, the young guy when he's trying to fight Rasputin. It's the same type of thing, like weird, slower running speed than it should be, and he goes to like punch him, and it just doesn't seem like naturally, like a natural flow of animation.
It is kind of weird.
It feels like they, you know what it feels like? Like, there's 24 frames of animation in a second, and it seems like they used the same shot for a couple more
frames.
A couple frames more than they should have, because it's like he's slugging through like Jell-O or something. You know, it's weird. You have to see it to understand what I'm talking about.
No, it is. Now, at this point, because Corso has been betrayed by Preed and the Dredge, so he, the double crosser's been double crossed. He ends up joining our heroes and helping them, sacrificing himself in order to get the Titan AE online. It comes online because Kale, hipster salad. Sorry, I'm just going to call him hipster salad. So hipster salad has decided that he is going to say, well, the dredge are 100% energy. We're going to tap into them because and use them to power.
That's the thing. He gets a message from his father that says, look.
Saying that they don't have enough power.
Yeah, the ship drained all or used up all of its power to essentially get here. So you need to figure out a way to repower
the
ship.
If you can get more power, then we're cool. So he decides, I'm going to tap into their power, steal, basically use their essence to power the machine and ergo create. So that's what he does.
It's essentially like a Star Trek techno babble scene where he's like,
I'm going to reverse the polarity on the Thetans.
If we reverse the polarity on the deflector dish, we can take in that energy and funnel it to the warp drive so that we can create a tachyon pulse that will reverberate through subspace and destroy their shield arrays.
Now that all sounds like it makes sense, but it's a techno babble.
Yeah, so. I just made up a bunch of shit. Like, I was doing that off the top of my head, because I've seen enough Star Trek.
Yeah, we've seen enough Star Trek, we can do it.
Yeah, but so, that's essentially what he does, is he absorbs all their power, and then there's, like, this shock wave that goes out and destroys the dredge.
Well, the dredge get destroyed, really, because their energy gets sapped. They get destroyed in that process. But then a new planet's formed, and scene.
Yeah, the Genesis planet is formed, and somehow...
Spock comes back to life.
Somehow... Kale and Akima get off that fucking ship. How? Because the ship essentially explodes.
Shh, details are important.
The ship essentially explodes and sucks in all the ice that's surrounding it and creates this new Genesis planet. Like, it does the swirly nebula thing.
So, Joy asked the same question.
And how the hell did they get off the ship?
My answer was that, because what happened is it sends the swirly energy, and then the ship comes out, and then it beams more energy into the swirl.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what happened, is they're protected inside the ship, and the ship pulls out of the swirl, and then the planet's created out away from the ship.
So then we get an end theme song.
And some credits.
And credits. Roll credits.
So and then also Hipster Salad wants to name the planet Bob.
Oh, yeah. He's like, it's my planet. I can name it whatever I want to. And he says, Planet Bob. And then
stupid.
She's
it's like a running joke that he has.
And he's like, well, why don't we just call it Earth 2? He's like, well, it's my planet. And then it shows like a year or two later, and all the humanity ships are coming towards the planet. And it gives it a subtitle that says Earth 2. And then in parentheses, it says Planet Bob.
Yeah.
So he actually named it Planet Bob.
It's like, it's funny, but it's also kind of dumb. Now this, remember I said, I know why the dredge hated humanity.
Why?
So the dredge hated humanity because they were pure energy, and the Titan project is something that required an immense amount of energy to power it.
So they felt existentially threatened by the Titan project?
Yes. And I think that the Titan never truly had power to begin with. That the ultimate plan for the Titan project was to use the dredge to power the project, because the amount of power that would be required would have been insane.
They would have had to basically drain a sun.
Yeah, so you drain a sun to make a planet. Cool, that seems stupid. But what if there's a alien race that is 100% energy and you could just drain them?
So maybe we were the aggressors and they were defending themselves.
That's right. So, see?
Humanity is the true monster.
I knew I'd find us a subtext somewhere.
Damn, humanity, you scary.
You scary, bitch. Yeah. So, I think at the end of the day, this ended up being something that I actually enjoyed.
Yeah. So
I know Joy did, because she rocked the shit out of this movie all the way through.
Yeah, like I said, the soundtrack, the underlying score of the movie was really a good selection of songs, because...
If you grew up in that time period, fuck, it's so nostalgic. I didn't care. Like, I was like, yeah, back to high school. Woo! Yeah, it was fun. I enjoy the music maybe more than anything. The animation's fine and it's cool. The CG was actually really good.
Yeah.
Story's compelling. My kid, she enjoyed it. But I would definitely recommend this.
Yeah, I would too. Going back and having rewatched it, to me... The story is good.
It's perplexing why it didn't do well.
Yeah, the story is good. You know, when stuff like this doesn't do well, I think back to my own ideas about like the show Futurama. When that show came out,
so brilliant.
No, here's my perception of it. When it came out in whatever it was, 97 or 98, whenever that was. Wasn't that when it came out?
I don't know off the top of my head.
Whenever it came out. When I first saw the show, all I could think of, because at that point, The Simpsons had been on for several years before. It didn't dawn on me that the same guy created both things. So all I could think of when I saw the show initially...
99.
Okay. So all I could think of when I saw the show initially was, this is just a cheap freaking ripoff of The Simpsons. And I actually didn't like it because of that. I didn't want to watch it because of that. It wasn't until later
that you really appreciated it for what it was.
Yeah, that I watched and I was like, actually, this show is really funny and clever, and it's really good and completely different than The Simpsons. It's just like Family Guy and American Dad. Made by the same guy, but very different. Very different tones.
I also felt like there's a lot more story that they wanted to tell.
Mm-hmm.
Given, and you could tell that by the fact that they had all of these alien races and mentions of other stuff like that. It was honestly not important for what we were there for. But I feel like they did that because they had the idea that they had other stories to tell. And they thought, oh, you know, when this movie blows up and makes us $500 million, we can go on and do a series or do multiple movies or sell comic books or, and it never happened. And then that was it. And I feel like they could, you know what, this movie, Fox, I think, still has the rights. I'm sure they do. They could just re-release it. Do a theatrical re-release.
Yeah.
So like a limited run. And then do a animated follow-up series on like Cartoon Network or a Boomerang or someplace. Or just screw it. Just do a remake.
So my point in all this was, I was trying to think that maybe there was another movie released in 2000 that... was
like that, ate up the box office.
That was similar. That, and really the only movies. Oh, this is a highest grossing. That's not the list that I wanted. But you have Emperor's New Groove, Chicken Run, Dinosaur, Titan A.E. obviously, Road to El Dorado, the Tigger movie, Titanic, The Legend Goes On.
Titanic, The Legend Goes On is the one that we've mentioned before, the weird animated one that JonTron covered.
Yeah. Joseph, King of Dreams, the Digimon movie, Rocky and Bullwinkle is not really animated. The Chipmunks Meet the Wolfman. So I don't know. Maybe there was another movie in there that people saw instead of that movie. Like, I don't know. I don't know why this movie didn't do that well. It was animated well. The writing was good. I thought the acting, aside from Drew Barrymore, was really kind of good.
Well, I think that was the year that American Psycho came out, and I think Gladiator came out, and the live-action Flintstones Viva Rock Vegas came out, and there's a few other things like Frequency, and, you know, oh, Battlefield Earth. Oh my God. Now, there's a stinker of a movie. Battlefield Earth. Yeah, there was not that many. Mission Impossible 2, Shanghai Noon, Big Mama's House.
This movie came out June 22nd, right?
Yeah, so what else came out around that time? It was Shaft, Fantasia 2000, and Gone in 60 Seconds, maybe? That's what came out in the week or two before.
Hmm.
And then after that was The Patriot and The Perfect Storm.
Me, Myself, and Irene.
And Me, Myself, and Irene. So I don't, you know, honestly.
Maybe it was just a bad box office.
I think, like, it was just a bad box office year.
Yeah.
Because The Patriot, I don't think, made a ton of money. I don't think Fantasia 2000 did. I think people maybe had some sort of, I think some people maybe had a little bit of theatrical fatigue, maybe. I mean, earlier in the year, there was Mission to Mars and Aaron Brockovich. I mean, there was a lot of those, like space-type movies.
Yeah. Who knows? But I would highly recommend going back and rewatching this movie. Because,
for sure, with your kids. It's fun with your kids. Although, there's, you know, the scene where the cockroach gets vaporized.
There's some violence
in
this
movie. And
the
neck snapping scene. So maybe not for a kid my age. Those were surprises for me, but she didn't understand them.
Yeah, I think this was the only Don Bluth movie to be rated PG.
Yeah, maybe keep it to like a 6 or 7 year old and up.
Yeah.
So,
but ultimately, I really enjoyed rewatching this movie, and
I would definitely recommend it.
I would too. So, if you want to find us and talk to us on Twitter, our Twitter handle is @remasteredcast. That is @remasteredcast.
You can also find us on Facebook. Just search for Childhood Remastered. Please rate us 5 stars on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. The rating really helps us out.
Yeah, and we'd also like to thank John Howarth for the use of our intro music, Nascent. You can find links to his SoundCloud on our website, childhoodremastered.com. And until next time, this is Sean.
And Chris.
And this has been your Childhood Remastered. We will see you next time.